Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Daphne Wisham of the Institute for Policy Studies, who assesses the disappointing outcome of the UN Climate Conference in Durban and the role the Obama administration played in the talks. Paul Billings of the American Lung Association, who talks about his group's fight to protect and strengthen clean air standards that could save thousands of lives. And April Tyler, an organizer with a December 10th march and rally at the United Nations in New York City, who talks about the launch of a national campaign to challenge Republican Party efforts to suppress voting rights. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Over the last week, thousands of pro-democracy protesters flooded the streets of Moscow, accusing the ruling United Russia Party of orchestrating a fraudulent vote count during the December 4th parliamentary elections. The size of the protests surprised authorities, political activists, and Kremlin security forces. Officially, United Russia lost 77 seats in the election and struggled to hold on to their parliamentary majority in the Duma. The protests were fueled by video posted on YouTube that depicted United Russia supporters stuffing ballot boxes and reports of inflated voter turnout in places like Chechnya. After the first night of protests on December 5th, police arrested over 300 activists, including Russian anti-corruption blogger Alexei Navalny, who dubbed United Russia, quote, a party of swindlers and thieves. On December 10th, a week after the disputed election, an estimated 50,000 people marched in Moscow demanding a new election. The week of protests was the largest since the fall of the Soviet Union 20 years ago. Putin, currently prime minister, is running for another term as president in elections to be held March 4th. U.S. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton called on the Kremlin to launch an official investigation into election fraud and manipulation. In response, Putin blamed the protests on American interference. Independent Moscow analyst Alexander Konovalov told the Christian Science Monitor, "No one expected the public mood to snap like this. These rallies caught everyone by surprise. Many new anti-Putin activists are followers of Navalny, who has exposed corruption inside the Kremlin at the state-run energy giant Gazprom and Russia's VTM Bank." As 2011 comes to a close, the year has seen the United States set a record for billion-dollar extreme weather disasters. Major storms, deaths, and record property damage occurred across the country, from a heat wave in Texas to a massive tropical storm that hit the Northeast, leaving millions of people without power. According to the Associated Press, the damage caused by severe storms this year has surpassed all the damage from extreme weather during the entire decade of the 1980s. Scientists attribute the extent of storm damage in 2011 to the growing impact of climate change and some bad luck. All told, 2011 witnessed over $52 billion worth of damages. In a recent speech, NOAA Administrator Jane Lubchenco called this year's extreme weather a harbinger of things to come, with more record heat waves, droughts, and big storms. California Governor Jerry Brown is promoting a 2012 ballot initiative to raise $7 billion in new taxes to address his state's chronic budget deficits. Brown's initiative, which makes an end run around the state legislature, includes a 1% tax hike on individuals making over $250,000 a year and a 2% tax hike in the income tax rate for people making over $500,000 a year. The proposal would also raise the state sales tax. If approved by California voters, the tax initiative would be a dramatic reversal of the 1978 Proposition 13 property tax cap passed in a referendum when Brown was serving his first term as governor. Jack Pitney, a professor at Claremont McKenna College in Pomona, opined, "If the tax measure goes down in defeat in a blue state facing a big deficit, the effect would be to chill similar proposals in other states for years to come." In New York State, Governor Andrew Cuomo won bipartisan backing for a tax reform plan to bring in nearly $2 billion a year in new government revenue. The plan, which raises tax rates for the wealthy, replaced an existing surtax on those making over $250,000 that was set to expire. ProPublica reports that many influential New York progressives were unhappy with Cuomo's tax plan, which reduced rates for taxpayers making over $300,000 from what they were paying under the state's earlier so-called millionaire's tax. Some observers say Cuomo's 11th-hour support for modest tax increases in some higher-income brackets was due to a changing political climate influenced by the Occupy Wall Street movement. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Reg Johnson.
As the 17th Conference of the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change in Durban, South Africa, concluded on December 11th, many environmental activists were disappointed with the results, but relieved that the talks hadn't collapsed. With the 1997 Kyoto Protocol Treaty on Global Warming set to expire, the conference in Durban was tasked with negotiating an agreed-upon path toward developing a new international treaty that will control greenhouse gas emissions. Negotiators from the European Union in Durban argued for a legally binding treaty that would cover the entire world, including developing nations that had been exempt under Kyoto. The 11th-hour agreement hammered out in Durban pledged to work toward a new global treaty by 2015, but due to objections from India and China, the legal force of such an agreement remains ambiguous. Negotiators in Durban also established a $100 billion green climate fund to assist poor nations in adapting to climate change and reduce their CO2 emissions. But the source of the money for the fund has not yet been settled. But while there was progress in some areas, leading scientists are alarmed that the conference in Durban failed to agree on any plan to dramatically cut emissions necessary to avoid the future destructive effects of global warming. Your reporter spoke with Daphne Wisham, co-director of the Institute for Policy Studies' Sustainable Energy and Economy Network. She summarizes the outcome of the UN Durban conference and the role the Obama administration played in the climate talks.
The Kyoto Protocol was destined to expire next year in 2012. What was agreed in Durban was that parties to the Kyoto Protocol would decide over the next year on whether or not to extend a second commitment period under the Kyoto Protocol. So that would essentially take us from 2013 till 2017. And it was agreed that they would take the next year on making that decision. So essentially what happened is that carbon markets got put on life support for another year, and perhaps at the end of next year they will continue until 2017. Next year, the conference of the parties will meet in the very undemocratic country of Qatar, and there are no commitments to emissions reductions from rich countries in the interim. Basically, what this means is that the Kyoto Protocol is on life support for the next year, and it's being potentially replaced by a new agreement that is even weaker unless we take action and make sure that that doesn't happen. The other thing that, you know, people are saying is a breakthrough is that all the parties agreed to legally binding emissions by 2020. We'll have to see how that plays out. Of course, China and India. China is now the number one greenhouse gas emitter. Their emissions have been rising quite dramatically over the last decade. And India's emissions are also beginning to head up in the uptick. But, you know, we have to keep in mind that these two countries have over 2 billion people combined and represent a significant share of the world's population, and they're just now beginning to come online. That doesn't mean they can't begin to develop in a way that avoids making the same mistakes that we have, but they still are experiencing quite significant levels of poverty. And, of course, we're exporting a lot of our coal from places like Wyoming, from the Powder River Basin, to China. So we're helping China and India burn lots and lots of coal, and we're culpable in their greenhouse gas emissions.
So if you were to assess the successes and failures of this Durban conference, what would you say would be the highlights and lowlights there?
The highlights are that we saw people power in force, you know, that we saw youth in particular speaking out boldly at the climate negotiations, risking arrest, standing up for their future. It is, after all, the young people that are going to be paying the highest price around the world. We saw, you know, the beginnings of discussions that absolutely do need to take place between all of the countries globally, and, you know, as some of the small island states rightfully say to India and China, you want the right to develop, we want the right just to survive, and clearly survival trumps development. So we're beginning to have the discussion that's a fairly difficult one involving some of the larger emitting developing countries as well as the poorer ones, and that's at least a step in the right direction. The problem is that the U.S., once again, is not only not joining the Kyoto Protocol in any meaningful way, they've refused to put any money on the table. They refused to agree to any binding emissions cuts. They've even refused to support something called the financial transactions tax, which could potentially raise $600 billion a year while also curbing financial speculation, which is something that all of us are beginning to learn a lot more about in the aftermath of this meltdown we're living through, of, in part as a result of financial speculation. And on the one hand, the Obama administration has, to some degree, had its hands tied at the national level by the Senate, by the fact that we have a Senate that will not even consider climate legislation, and some senators who think that climate change doesn't even exist. So, you know, the Obama administration gets some sympathy on that level, but it gets no sympathy for actively trying to obstruct some of the talks that were going on at the international level. We kept hearing that Obama's negotiators were playing a negative role in obstructing progress at the international level, and that is absolutely shameful. Regardless of all of this climate science denial that's coming out of the U.S. And perhaps some other countries as well, the world passed the $1 trillion mark in clean energy investment since 2004. I think the future will be clean. It's just a question of how much damage we'll do in the interim, and hopefully, you know, people can take heart and know that people power really is making a difference in this country, and we've just got to keep it up.
That was Daphne Wisham, co-director of the Institute for Policy Studies Sustainable Energy and Economy Network. Find more analysis and commentary on the issue of climate change on our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. There's good news and bad news coming out of Congress and the administration on air pollution. On the one hand, the Environmental Protection Agency is proposing new air toxic standards for industrial boilers, which, if implemented, would prevent up to 8,100 premature deaths each year. On the other hand, President Obama recently passed up a chance to implement stricter EPA standards on ground-level ozone, or smog. He based his decision on the cost to business, despite scientific research finding that the regulations would have prevented an estimated 12,000 premature deaths annually. Meanwhile, the assault on the environment is going on full force in the Republican-controlled House of Representatives, which on November 30th passed Bill H.R. 1633 out of the Energy and Commerce Committee that would exempt arsenic, heavy metals, and industrial mining operations from regulations under the Clean Air Act. Exempt sources include massive open-pit mines, smelters, cement plants, and coal processing plants. By one congressional insider's count, Republicans in the House have introduced 170 anti-environment bills since they took control of that chamber after the 2010 elections. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with Paul Billings, Vice President for National Policy and Advocacy at the American Lung Association, which has been in the forefront of the fight to protect and improve clean air standards. He discusses the status of industrial boiler regulations, H.R. 1633, and President Obama's decision to kill tighter smog regulations.
This is a proposal, so they have to take public comment, and then they will hopefully finalize it in the spring of next year. So it's the first step in a process, and this has been a long process for these rules. And in fact, EPA proposed some rules earlier this year that then these are a reconsideration or a replacement for those, so they got better and more information from the regulated industry to move forward with these rules. EPA is also poised to do rules to clean up power plants that are due out by December 16th, which EPA estimates will save up to 17,000 premature deaths each year. So there are a lot of big rules pending that will have big public health benefits, and the important thing is getting them across the finish line and into law.
These proposed rules don't have to go through Congress, do they?
They don't have to go through Congress, though Congress can attempt to block them. And in fact, the House of Representatives already passed a bill that would delay the cleanup of toxic air pollution like mercury and arsenic from these boilers and change the rules forever by which EPA could regulate these pollutants in the future. So the House of Representatives really is on a campaign against public health protections, common sense regulation, and has passed a number of bills that would block, delay, or eviscerate Clean Air Act authority. The good news is that the United States Senate has stood strong and said no, and said no repeatedly, and the president has threatened to veto these bills should they reach his desk.
So it seems like it's kind of a mixed bag. You know, the president says he would veto these bills if they get to his desk, but when it was really up to him to allow the smog rule to go forward, he didn't do it.
It certainly is a mixed bag, and so it's really important that EPA does move forward with these rules to clean up the boilers, which are hopefully get done by early next year, these rules to clean up power plants, which are expected to come forward, and they're under a quarter deadline to meet that December 16th date. So we're all watching and hoping, but at the same time, very powerful interests, very moneyed interests, the Edison Electric Institute and very, very large power companies are throwing everything they can at these EPA rules to try to block and delay them and try to derail them.
Paul Billings, they're not saying they're against clean air. They're saying these new rules would be prohibitively expensive to meet and would cost jobs. Isn't that their stated position?
Yeah, they take a number of tacks to oppose these public health protections. They complain about the costs, even though the benefits far outweigh the costs. They do claim that we are in economic tough times. But at the same time, I've worked on these issues for more than 20 years. Even in economic good times, when EPA has been moving forward with clean air rules, they've complained about these things as well. So I think they trot out the same arguments each time. Generally, they don't debate about the health benefits, but even in this most recent debate with the electric companies, they've argued that mercury doesn't harm kids and there aren't benefits from these rules for protecting health and saving lives. So they're even trying to argue the health benefits, which are clearly and well established. So I wouldn't say that they don't debate whether there are clean air benefits. They try every argument they can, because what they don't want to do is make the investments to modernize their facilities, to make them more efficient, more competitive, and to provide clean air to the people that live in their communities and people live hundreds of miles away from these facilities as well.
But they live there, and their children and grandchildren live there. Clean air seems like something that human beings should be able to agree on. It seems crazy to me.
I can't explain it, because the issue of the power plant, half the power plants in the country have already installed some of these modern pollution controls. So this is not a situation where this can't be done or hasn't been done. And so it's hard to understand why folks would oppose it. It has to be a motivation for their profit motive. They don't want to make the investment. They don't want to modernize these plants. It's hard to understand, because we all do breathe the air. We all do drink the water. And I've never met anybody yet that's argued that the air is too clean or the water is too safe to drink.
How would you rate the Obama administration on this key issue of clean air?
Well, we are very disappointed and angry at the president's decision on ozone smog that he made in September, and we are suing the administration in court to enforce the law and follow the science to compel a safe ozone standard, a smog standard, to be set. I guess we're also watching this decision that's being made in the next 2 weeks with respect to cleaning up toxic mercury and arsenic and acid gases from power plants, and to see how we can evaluate this administration. It's really important that we put public health first, follow the science and the law, and protect people and save lives. I think it's just really important for the public to understand that there is a concerted effort in the House of Representatives to roll back these public health protections, these safeguards, and that only if the public speaks out and lets Congress know that they want air that's clean and healthy to breathe, and let their officials know that they care, we'll be able to stop these attacks and make sure that we move forward with protecting public health and providing clean air for all Americans.
That was Paul Billings, Vice President for National Policy and Advocacy at the American Lung Association. Find more information on the fight for clean air by visiting our website at btlonline.org. Since Republican candidates scored major victories for state offices across the U.S. last November, state governments controlled by the GOP have passed numerous measures restricting the right of targeted constituencies to cast ballots. A recent report by the NAACP Legal Defense and Education Fund titled Defending Democracy, Confronting Modern Barriers to Voting Rights in America, documents what the group asserts is a coordinated assault on minorities' voting rights who often heavily favored Democratic candidates. The report found that in more than a dozen states, measures have been signed into law during 2011 that impose new restrictions on the types of voter IDs required to cast a ballot, limiting the number of days for early voting, marginalizing student voters, creating unnecessary obstacles for groups registering new voters, as well as disenfranchising the disabled and ex-felons. The study concluded that if these restrictions were not reversed, more than 5 million Americans may be denied the right to vote, a fact that could dramatically change the outcome of state and federal election results, as well as the race for the White House. A coalition of more than 100 groups led by the NAACP came together in New York City for a protest at the United Nations on December 10th to launch a national campaign to challenge restrictions on voting rights. The march, that organizers say drew 20 to 25,000 participants, began at the headquarters of the billionaire Koch brothers, who provided $1 million in funding to the American Legislative Exchange Council, or ALEC, that designed many of the legislative templates to restrict voting rights. Your reporter spoke with April Tyler, an organizer with the December 10th Mobilization Committee, who talks about the ways in which the National Standing for Freedom campaign will work to reverse Republican Party measures to suppress voting rights.
Well, the bottom line message is, one, that we have got to be ever vigilant. And we remember, many of us who are African American and immigrants, activists from the 1950s, 1960s, we remember the Jim Crow laws, and we remember when, or, you know, I don't remember because I'm too young, but my parents and grandparents remember when there were poll taxes, there were literacy tests, when people really did not have the right to vote. And, you know, I've studied my civil rights history, so I know that there were lots of people who fought and who died for me to have the right to vote. And so the bottom line message was that we fought for this right. Many of us died for this right. Many of our brothers and sisters and even our family members died for us to have the right to vote. So we cannot sit still and let the rights be eroded. We also stood before the United Nations on UN Human Rights Day because we feel that this is not just a civil right, it's not just a constitutional right, it's a human right to be able to participate in the governance of your country. And we aim to not only beat back these efforts, but to broaden the voting rights for more people in this country.
April, tell us what's going on in states around the country that are controlled by Republican governors and legislatures regarding restrictions imposed on the right to vote, for example, imposing strict voter ID regulations, limiting early voting, marginalizing student voters, and throwing up obstacles on registering new voters. It's a long list of things in a long list of states, but if you could summarize some of the things that concern you most.
Okay, in almost 40 states across the country, there either has been laws passed in recent years, the last couple of years, or laws introduced to require specific voter identification, photo voter identification. And we see this as a problem because in order to obtain those specific types of identification, you have to either have particular documents or to prove your identity, or you've got to purchase those documents. So we see this as a backdoor poll tax. Additionally, we see a problem with the efforts to restrict student voting, requiring specific forms of student identification. And specifically in Texas, if you have a gun license issued by the National Rifle Association, you can vote. But if you got a student identification card issued from the University of Texas, you may not be able to vote. Additionally, in specific states, particularly across the South, where on Sundays, the last Sunday before Election Day, they would organize what they call souls to the polls. And after service, people would go together and vote. And they've now eliminated that in at least two states and have it pending in a few other states. So those, as well as a few other issues, we see is very problematic. And we see it as targeted toward students, elderly, disabled, minorities, immigrants, who would be, we're the 99%. We're not going to vote for eliminating the millionaire's tax. And we're going to vote for more progressive issues. And the effort, which is funded in large part by, the Koch brothers and conservative organizations, is targeted at restricting our access.
How is your coalition addressing a remedy here? I guess there's a couple of avenues you could take, going through the courts, the U.S. Justice Department pursuing violations of the United States Civil Rights Act. You could also take the direct action route, realizing that voting rights are an essential element to democracy. And we certainly have many examples in U.S. history where direct action was taken to preserve the right to vote. Where are you targeting your efforts right now?
All of the above. There are legal efforts in each state where these laws have passed or are being proposed. There's actually conversations with the U.S. Justice Department about pushing back and being ever vigilant when the districts that have to be pre-approved by the Justice Department come before them. And we are also doing direct action across the nation. December 10th was just the kickoff. With the NAACP and the coalition that was formed and that is still growing, we plan to, keep this on the front burner throughout, the next couple of years at least.
That was April Tyler, an organizer with the December 10th Mobilization Committee. Find links to more information on the campaign to overturn restrictions on voting rights at our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by writing us at mail@btlonline.org. Visit our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Hank Hoffman, Reg Johnson, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.